On your journey through life, you are the hero. There are times, however, when it is beneficial to have an advisor to guide you along your path. Welcome to the Smart Money Simplified Podcast with Brent Mikosh, certified financial planner, certified investment management analyst, and co-founder of MP Advisors LLC. In this podcast, Brent discusses some of the most important and interesting topics of the day as they relate to finance, the economy, and beyond. Now, on to the show.
Hello and welcome to Smart Money Simplified with Brent Mikosh. Brent has a guest in studio and he's given me the honor of introducing him. Today's guest is David Martin. David is the president and founder of Fantasy Interactive. With offices in New York, San Francisco, Miami, and London, Fantasy is a human-centered product innovation team that ships premium products and ecosystems for the world's biggest brands. Since launching the company in 1999, David has worked with some of the world's most important companies, including Netflix, Xbox, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, MTV, Ford, Porsche, Huawei, Samsung, Tinder, and MasterClass. David now also works in a chief creative officer capacity directly with Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, Richard Yu, CEO at Huawei. Brent, okay, this bio is incredibly impressive. Why'd you bring David on the show today?
Well, I think the bio speaks for itself, right? Really. Yeah. I mean, David, I've known David now for about 2 years. And I get a lot of questions from clients about what's happening with artificial intelligence. How is this going to impact our lives moving forward? What are some of the things that we should know? And I've got a basic understanding of what's happening. And, you know, we're invested in some of the publicly traded companies that are key players in this space. But David knows a lot more about this than I do, and I asked him to come in and talk to us a little bit about what's happening in this field, and he was kind enough to say yes.
I am really excited. This has been on my mind for a long time as well. You know, movies make it extreme, and I just need to know what's really going on. So thank you so much for bringing him in.
Absolutely. I think we're going to get some good answers today. So David, thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. All right. Where do you want to start?
Let's start at the basics for people that, I mean, artificial intelligence, we think of HAL from 2010 Space Odyssey, or right. We think of the Terminator, we think of all those
Matrix.
Different things. Matrix, or we think of, you know, our apps, of Alexa and everything else.
Right.
Let's broadly define what this thing is we're talking about, because no one can really pinpoint exactly what it is.
Right. Well, I mean, look, AI is obviously short for artificial intelligence, and that word has been out there for years, decades at this point, right? And it's not really a right word. It's an incorrect word. Artificial intelligence sounds, you know, literally from a sci-fi movie, right? Which it is. And today it's becoming a reality. And as we know more about artificial intelligence, we kind of know now even the name artificial doesn't make any sense. And I'll get into that in a second. But to really understand what artificial intelligence is and the impact it has on day-to-day life today and the impact it will have in the future, we need to really understand actually what is the human brain when it comes to intelligence. What is the cortex and what is digital intelligence? What's the differences? And just by giving you some context around that, I think it will start to open people's minds exactly how it can be utilized and the concerns and the possibilities about the future. So if we take a step back, which is one of those conversations, before we can answer the initial questions, we should take a couple of steps back, right? So, you know, what qualifies me to sit here and talk about AI? There's not a ton. I mean, I'm not there writing AI code. I'm not a developer, but I'm a designer. So for the past 20 years, I've been working with digital ecosystems, right? So as you know, an iPhone, an operating system is on that phone, right? And it's connected to lots of different applications. Ultimately, that's a digital ecosystem. So we create operating systems, and we've been doing that for two decades. The difference over the past 10 years is those operating systems are becoming smarter and smarter. And AI, to the majority of people, is algorithms that are working for you to help you make mundane work easier, right? So, for example, if we talk about the generic applications, how AI is used today, it would be things, for example, like Alexa Voice, right? Search results, dating. So when you go into dating apps, how it tries to use AI to understand how your profile matches another profile. So those are the basic algorithms that are in play today. And they've been in play for a decade, more than a decade. But if I read a quote here, I think it's a good one. It's from a software journalist. Her name is Kaya Ismail. And she says, an algorithm is simply a set of instructions, right? It's a formula for processing data. And AI takes this to another level and can be made up of a set of algorithms. To then it has the capacity to change those algorithms. So algorithms is, what is an algorithm? An algorithm is trying to give a command to a computer. So if I'm a programmer and I want a certain application, an app or a website or a program to do something, it's based on a set of rules. So I say, if this light turns red, then do this.
Yeah.
If that light turns green, then do this. And that is the standard way everything that you know today is programmed. It's a set of rules that we create as developers. The difference is the perception of AI is that those algorithms have now outgrown themselves. So they're able to almost learn from their own algorithms, right? And improve upon that. And that is the perception of AI. We are not there. We are absolutely not there yet. There are certain things called machine learning. Machine learning is there in a small capacity where certain algorithms learn based on its trends, its data, its outputs to, you know, how to manipulate the solution based on raw data. But that is far from the reality that we're in today. But it's coming extremely fast.
Yeah.
So before we go into all the big exciting conversation and the crazy stuff we're about to talk about, it's just good to understand where we are today. An algorithm ultimately is a set of instructions based on data, and those instructions help make mundane tasks better. So for example, what are those basic applications? So for example, at Google, right, they've been using AI for quite a while to do with search, how things come up in your Gmail, how there's certain priority items. There's a massive infrastructure within the digital ecosystem at Google that has AI foundation, but it's AI foundation in kind of more the basic algorithm principles. It's not in any way super intelligence or anything scary. So today, healthcare, for example, has a massive amount of AI applications, but it has also some of the biggest opportunities to gain from AI. So for example, we could take a camera and we can scan a mole, and based on AI algorithms today, we can determine very quickly if that mole or something like that is cancerous, right? And all that's doing is the camera takes the photo of the mole, it uploads it to the cloud, and the algorithm on the server side within the healthcare ecosystem ultimately tries to match millions of different photos and tiny pixel details and references to try to figure out within seconds if there's a cancerous component to that mole, right? Now, it's never obviously within 100% accuracy, but if you were to give me a picture of your mole and then I have to go and cross-reference it with a million photos, it would take me weeks.
Or longer. Yeah.
So that is ultimately AI today that exists in the majority of platforms. It's at that level. It's not really more dangerous, more exciting than that. The same goes for, let's say, Alexa. Alexa would be one of the larger used AI components out there. So when you say, hey, Alexa, and you ask it a command, it's trying to understand your voice. So if you say the word what, on the back end, within milliseconds, it tries to understand, is he saying what? What's the grammar he's saying it in? And quickly tries to make sense of it. And that's all done in splits milliseconds, right? That's why voice works, and that's AI. So AI today looks at one particular function and it does an okay job. We are far from thinking AI is actually super helpful. I mean, if you use Alexa in a home, in a smart home, you realize that it actually sucks in so many ways. We're so far from being there. However, the most exciting part of this conversation today is the fact that we have so far to go, and we've not even seen the surface, let alone scratched it. We haven't even seen it. So, you know, if we talk about AI in the future, there really should be two focuses. There's concern, and the other is applications, how it can be utilized. So before we go into concern, because that's going to take up the majority of this conversation, and it's good and bad concerns, right? The way I think people are going to be very impressed in the next 10 years with how AI will come into their lives will be in things like, let's say you watch a movie, right? So we designed Netflix, for example, right? We designed the user interface for Netflix, a whole bunch of different streaming services, and do essentially the operating system there, right? So there's a lot of data we get when we work with, let's say, likes of Tinder, Facebook, Twitter, all these clients that we have. We have a massive amount of data. We understand how their users think, what they're moving towards, what they're clicking on. You know, we've got 20 years of enormous amount of our own machine learning, if you will, based on humans. But going forward, you know, how do you redesign Netflix for the future? So you think people are going to be sitting there, you know, as they do today, going through the same old interface in Disney Plus and Netflix to watch a movie? No, that's going to change completely. So by the time our kids, because you and I both have kids in the same class, right? That's how we met. And by the time these kids are you know, our age, right? They're going to be watching movies with them in it. So as we know, actors like Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, all this kind of stuff that we know, these celebrities, imagine in the future, it's not really going to be like that. It's going to be, you're going to watch any movie you want, Home Alone. At Christmas time, let's watch Home Alone, but I want my own kids to be in Home Alone, right? So we're able to scan your face and seamlessly implement that face and the body language and even the voice then into a movie. So this is the practical application of where AI is going. It's fun, entertaining in a lot of ways. How you do, you can take an old photo, you can bring it to life, all that kind of stuff. That's the basic next 5 to 10 years. And we're already in the midst of that. Now, right now, the paradigm shift is happening across the board with AI, even in healthcare. So for example, another future basic application that's already coming. We've been working with Kohler, you know, the folks that manufacture toilets and sinks, showers. So one of the things I've been always passionate about is the toilet. It sounds crazy, right? So the toilet is one thing that you and I have used since we've been kids, and it's never changed, right? It's the same thing. Our parents put us on it for the first time. It looks the same. It works the same. Just nothing different about the damn toilet. Almost everything in life that we know gets some kind of smart upgrade, but not the toilet. And the toilet...
Except in Japan.
Well, you got the heated seats and all that kind of stuff, sprinkles, cleans you, whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. The toilet is the number one thing in life that we give something to, and we get nothing back in return.
You could get all that medical information.
Exactly. Yeah. So imagine I'm going to the bathroom, and, you know, it tells me within 30 seconds you're pregnant.
Right.
You're low in vitamin D. You've got early signs of pancreatic cancer. These are the things where quickly, based on sensors, sensor technology is a massive evolving thing, combined with AI, it's telling us very quickly, you know, how we can be preventative. You know, how, because every day, you know, when you go to the doctor, or every year you go to the doctor X amount of times, not that many. You know, the average person gets a blood test not that many times a year, if ever, right? But if every day we can be getting data from you, if you need the bathroom, right? The goal to really reduce, you know, disease is going to be massively impacted by being preventative versus being reactive. And obviously being preventative, it's not on the exact side of healthcare companies like Pfizer, who sell a lot of, which is one of our clients, who sell a lot of, obviously, their products for a lot of money. You know, preventative healthcare is something where AI is going to play a massive role, where it's going to significantly reduce diseases in the world, as well as trying to cure diseases with larger AI supercomputers. So these are the practical examples of where AI is really going to play a role that's going to be exciting in the next 5 to 10 years. And there's going to be a million examples. But what happens as we get a little further? Not even 10, 20 years.
If I can interject something really quick, you bring up two points, particularly with medical information. For me, all of this stuff has to hinge on some sort of a morality behind it.
Right.
Because if you lose that degree of privacy and this data suddenly becomes the property of corporations or the government or large institutions, I mean, to me, as someone that's a huge advocate for privacy, that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what the trade-off is between early cancer detection, which I guess if it was me, I would hope that you had that detection,
right?
And just this loss of autonomy in so many other areas. So when I hear you talk about those things, on one hand, I'm like, that's absolutely incredible. And I know a lot of people that have died of cancer. Man, if they had had that kind of information so mm-hmm. early, their lives are probably saved.
Right.
But there's always an ugly side to that coin. You have the nice shiny side that looks fantastic. You turn that coin over, and it's really ugly really fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you, in a world with a lot of competing moralities, how do you possibly underpin, and we're not even touching the surface of what I think you're going to go with some sense of morality in terms of what it means to be a human being?
Well, I mean, that the morality and AI are two conflicting beasts, and the kind of rules of how artificial intelligence should be set up under a democratic infrastructure is going to have to thoroughly address the morality of how that may play. But I think there's two questions here. One, how does morality play in the future of our AI decisions? But how does it play also in reality to privacy, for example, when we're getting data from the bathroom on a daily basis, right? To make sure that that data is protected, obviously. So obviously, you know, today we have HIPAA where, you know, we go to our doctor, they can't reveal anything about us, right? They have to keep it very private. So naturally, any future technology that's coming that's enabling you to understand, you know, what your heart rate is, your EKG stuff, data from whatever you give it has to be private. So for example, are you familiar with 23andMe?
Yes.
So we designed 23andMe, right?
Oh, I know that. Well.
And so, you know, I remember when we originally got 23andMe, the Excel, it was a massive Excel sheet. And they gave us this massive Excel sheet. Said, here's an example of all the data that we get, right? And from genes. And we need to turn this into a product that consumers are willing to pay for to be able to, you know, plan their family tree or look at their healthcare, you know, and probably have some kind of preventative output from that, right? So obviously it was very sensitive data. And, you know, obviously cybersecurity, whether it's healthcare, whether it's anything, is going to become a massive, more important industry and beast than it is today, especially as we go forward with AI. So ultimately, privacy is definitely going to be its own conversation of how to protect that. But it's really going to be around similar infrastructures that we have today, such as HIPAA, such as cybersecurity, for any kind of future tech. But I'm not really worried about privacy so much because that's something that we control.
Sort of, because HIPAA is not applying if you're at a restaurant in New York City.
True.
They want proof that you've had a medical procedure.
That is tech. Well, just
that's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation, right? But the reality is that you don't have to, if you don't want to go to the restaurant, obviously you don't have to volunteer it. And eventually, I'm sure that would be gone. It's ridiculous. COVID is a bit of a bubble in terms of, you know, everything's very reactionary. It's not really properly thought through, not properly voted on, all the mandates, all this kind of stuff. The government are just, you know, if you look at government in New Zealand, how everything's super locked down, and the government of Denmark yesterday announced that they're reopening on Tuesday, that COVID's done, that's it.
Yes.
You know, so two completely conflicting countries that are typically on the same team normally, they have completely different operational models to it. And because they're all just panicking.
Correct.
They don't really, so COVID's a bubble. But the reality, going forward, the democratic society around digital and AI is really going to play center field, right? Because what we know about privacy invasion is we haven't ever really been invaded properly. What's coming, because everything about your body and everything about your brain, your mental health, is all going to become a digital signature in the future, whether you like it or not. That's where it's going. And this is where the concerns really start to come in. So let's look at some of the concerns, right, about artificial intelligence. So to get perspective, right, a human is an intelligent person, right? Semi-intelligent, would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the reason you're intelligent is because you have a cortex in your brain, right? And the rest of your body and your brain just makes everything work biologically. But your cortex is where kind of your thoughts are, your kind of self-consciousness and stuff like that, right? Now, within that cortex of the human brain, this is where it gets crazy. That cortex has neurons, for example, that can fire up to, for example, 5 times a second, right? All the way up to maybe maximum 200 times per second. It can fire off information, right? So just keep that in mind for a second. But before we go there, let's talk about the discovery of AI, what AI really, really is coming. So when did humanity start to kind of really change? It started, in my opinion, in 1879 when Edison invented electricity, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I know you, I'm here today, I'm from Ireland, I'm here today, I'm listening to myself in headphones, I'm driving the car I drive, I'm in this air-conditioned room with these lights, all because of electricity. If it wasn't for electricity, the kind of machinery we'd have to make planes, to make this, to do this, to make the internet, to watch TV, to get entertained, to have ambitions to go to different countries, wouldn't exist without electricity. So electricity is probably one, if not the biggest invention of all humanity, right? Now, That's amazing, because I mean, if you look before electricity was invented, there wasn't really much going on in humanity. And then electricity came, and look how quickly everything changed, right? Now, the next major item that was waiting to be discovered for a billion years was the atom, okay? And what happened in 1945 when we discovered the atom? We designed the nuclear bomb, right? Which is ultimately, you know, a natural worry of every human on the planet that understands what a nuclear bomb is, especially at the moment when we're potentially about to see a conflict in Ukraine and in Taiwan, right? With two superpowers we don't want to really get into a fight with.
Right.
So the nuclear, you know, weapons, bombs, atoms, how to manipulate them, ultimately came along in 1945, right? After this massive span of humanity. Now, AI is your electricity, you got the atom, and then the next thing is AI. Now, to give you a perspective, although you thought electricity was a major change in humanity, and then the atom bomb was a major change in humanity, AI looks to me that it will dwarf both of those together, dwarf it. Because this is where humanity, we are either going to completely lose humanity, or we're going to be able to somehow keep it at bay. I don't know yet. So it's pretty scary. And why it's scary is because if you look at back to the cortex, the human brain, where we can, let's say, max fire 200, you know, we can give 200 commands per second, right? Let's say with a neuron in your brain, right? The data within a digital superintelligence, right? And AI... remember I said artificial intelligence is not really the right word.
Yeah.
So a super intelligence, a digital super intelligence, which ultimately is, you know, for lack of what the average person knows today, is like an AI bot in the future, right? That will have the capacity, right? Let's pretend we build a computer the size of my brain, and that already can fire up, you know, 1,000 times more neurons per second than my cortex can. Then the neurons themselves, they travel, right, at you know, 100 meters a second. And so when you think, your neuron, your thinking goes at 100 meters a second. Within a computer the size of my brain, that neuron is outpacing it, and it's traveling at the speed of light, right? So the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second, right? So that means the Earth is, let's say, 24,000 miles around. So if I'm going to run around the Earth, it's going to be 25,000 miles to run around that. At the speed of light, that I get around that Earth 7.5 times in 1 second, right?
Yeah.
So very, very quick, very, very fast. And remember, in comparison to my brain sending a neuron, it's 100 meters a second. So within that second, I can go 100 meters. Right, the brain can go 100 meters a second. And within the same brain size, that's a computer, it can go obviously far faster, right? Now imagine then I take that brain and I make it not just the size of my own brain, but I make it the size of an entire warehouse, let's say a massive Walmart, and I jam it with processors and computers, which we have today. Now imagine the size of that brain compared to mine. It's far, far bigger. Far, far bigger. It can compute tasks far quicker than my own neurons and cortex can. Far, far quicker. So you can imagine that if just the physical entity on the size of that brain compared to my brain, right, that the power of that brain to do things is beyond almost comprehension. Like most humans don't understand really the size of the universe. People have an idea, but most people, you go out in the street and you ask most people, what's the speed of light? 700 miles an hour, 400 miles an hour. You know, I've done it. I've done it in an experiment. I had to go out to the street, ask people, what's the speed of light? Almost nobody knows what's going on. So AI has a similar thing where the capabilities of AI based on the physical size of the technology compared to our brain is something that we really have to take into play here, because that's where things are going. So, you know, do you want to ask something on that?
Yeah, and I would also consider the two that, you know, you're talking about the human brain working at 100 meters a second versus the speed of light.
Right.
we are also, we have brains that are working slower.
Right.
We're also limited by our fingers, by our mouths.
The thumbs.
By our thumbs. Mm-hmm. By so the actual transfer rate of the information that we might actually be able to compute in our heads is nothing. Where you take two of your Walmart-sized super brains and the amount of what we have spent, you know, a little bit of time here discussing happens in the flash. It's an instant. It doesn't even compute.
No. It's insignificant.
Yeah.
You know, insignificant. So right now, the point of this is that ASI is dormant. So ASI stands for Artificial Super Intelligence. It really should be DSI, Digital Super Intelligence, because there's nothing artificial about this in the future. Artificial is something that sounds almost like fake. It's something that we can almost turn on, turn off, right? Like, I wish we move away from the word artificial, because we're really creating another being, another intelligence, right? And digital superintelligence, ultimately, it's sitting there. It's like the atom was for billions of years. It's dormant, right? And once we get that machine learning to a level where it's really starting to learn and manipulate, and where it's really running well in the big supercomputer warehouse infrastructures, that's when we start moving into machine consciousness. So right now, you and I are conscious, right? I know who you are. I know you're sitting in front of me. I can understand your thoughts. I can get my thoughts over to you. You know, we have general, you know, reactions from each other's body language. You know, I'm self-aware that I'm here. I'm conscious. So I have empathy of thoughts, all sorts of feelings, stuff that a computer doesn't have. But if a machine becomes conscious, right? So, I mean, you and I, although we're biological, let's pretend we're not. We're technically, our heart, our skin, it's technically all made up of synthetic stuff. And so ultimately we could be robots. Robots is even sounds like a silly thing, but we could be basically completely man-made in the future, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not that difficult to replace certain things. The main thing that we have difficulty with is understanding consciousness and how to, you know, repurpose that. That's why we can't bring anyone back from the dead, right? We can't spark, you know, that consciousness back. But with machines and algorithms on top of algorithms that learn from one another, that ultimately let's exponentially get a lot more crazy, that's when you get into the machine consciousness, so which is ultimately digital super intelligence, right? So DSI is the thing that we need to really think about in the future, right? Because again, there's going to be a ton of applications over the next 5-10 years that humans are all going to, oh my God, this is AI, this is great. It's doing X for me, doing Y for me. It's much easier to get my home to look after security for me. You know, I can watch all these movies with my kids in it. You know, it's amazing. And that's all great on the surface. But once we get to that machine consciousness component, which we are getting to, it's coming. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And it's not 100 years in the future. It might not even be 15 years in the future, right? It's sitting there and everyone is working really hard on it right now to figure out to get that algorithm to just get in that motion, to get it to flow, to really understand itself and ultimately become, for lack of a better term, alive. Now, if it becomes alive, you know, people instantly go to things like The Matrix, or they go to, you know, all sorts of different crazy sci-fi movies. And that's okay, because that's all they know what AI is. Now, the key, you ask a lot of experts out there, you know, what do we think ASI needs, artificial superintelligence, which is the real danger. So we know what we need it to be cognitive. So we need it to be able to learn, to store, but also to comprehend, right? We need it to be able to think. So AI needs to have morality, ethics, rationale, artistic creation, experimentation for science, but it also needs to be able to work with logic. And then it needs to be responsive, right? Almost a human level of responsiveness. And without that, it's going to be very hard for humans to build a relationship with AI that doesn't become divisive. So when we set up, you know, ASI, we needed to be democratized. You know, if it's not democratized, it's just going to run rampant. And as you mentioned, you know, two sides of the coin, one shiny side and one very dirty side.
What do you mean democratized when you say that?
We need a set of ultimately a set of rules, a set of rules that is designed by humanity on behalf of the governments and the best people on the planet to ultimately set up, you know, an operating rule set that AI is allowed to work within. So once AI becomes machine conscious, right, we need to be best friends with that machine. We need to make sure it's operating within a realm where it can't go rogue, where only people that are involved in programming and developing the algorithms and the ASI are operating within a predefined set of rules, processes, outputs, actions. Was without it, the reality is that it can just get away from us very quickly. So you can't just open the doors and go, well, anyone can just go and come in here and play with this, especially if it's machine conscious. You know, we it can just easily just run out of control.
But let me ask you this. Since the dawn of humanity, since when have human beings ever followed rules? And you talk about right. And you talk about a single, I guess, morality that's associated with how we attempt to govern something like this. The morality in China is vastly different than the reality in the United States.
Right.
There is no even single human set of morality.
Right.
And if you start looking basically purely on logic, well, purely on logic, it doesn't make sense to keep somebody beyond their useful life even alive. Yet we do it every single day. So human beings don't operate according to the rules a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely have different moralities, and logic almost never applies. So you're looking at creating something that's entirely different. It's an entirely different species than what we're talking about. And you're doing it in a way that is a hell of a lot more powerful than us immediately. And what's to say that a consciousness like this that arises doesn't look at us and be like, what are you going to do about it?
Right. And that's obviously the first natural thought of anyone that doesn't know what's coming and what it is. They're naturally, and rightfully so, afraid of that. But, you know, we'll get to China in a bit and Russia, because there's definitely a conversation around DSI, digital superintelligence, that Russia and China both have a focus on, and the American government have a different focus. So we've been working with China, specifically Huawei, which is the biggest real tech company in China. They own the majority of the telecommunications networks. They're the biggest operating system in the world. You know, we designed their OS, right? And I work with their CEO, Richard, and in China, you know, they're gods. They're the people that are out there really creating the future for China. You know, and of course, Americans have already been pretty scared of that. They're worried about spy devices and all that kind of stuff, and which was crazy for us because we're sitting in California designing the operating system, right, in yeah. San Francisco. And the American government are worried about, you know, that, but then they don't understand there's an American design agency in San Francisco, in London and New York, working on basically me driving this artificial intelligence operating system for the future of Huawei, right? And we're not doing the development, we're designing how users interact with it, how it looks, how it feels, what you touch, how you kind of, when you open the phone for the first time, how you're onboarded to it and all that kind of stuff, right? Like when you get in a test and you open it for the first time, how it all works, kind of same stuff.
Yeah.
So China have been very much focused on AI with voice, operating systems, all that kind of stuff from the private sector, if you will. Right. But the rest of the world, particularly America, same thing. But on the military side, China are leagues ahead of the United States. Leagues. I mean, even the U.S. government, the Pentagon, all in the past 2-3 months have come out, both in terms of hypersonic missiles and artificial intelligence, to say we're in deep trouble in the United States. Like, we're so far behind China in getting to machine consciousness to be able to build a better infrastructure. So this is now where it starts to get even really more interesting. So a lot of people would ask the question, okay, as AI comes, is it going to replace my job? You know, tomorrow, no. But in 10 years, yes. Like, for example, all the Uber drivers, we're not going to need them, right? The delivery drivers, we're not going to need them. Train drivers, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to need them. When it comes to, even today in factories, just if you look at most factories out there that are advanced, there's a lot of stuff those factories already do today that have for decades replaced humans, right? Now, there is a ton of jobs that are going to be done by AI, a ton, to the point where the majority of jobs, even the for lack of a better term or analogy, even the president of the United States, which doesn't look like a tough job at the moment, the you know, AI would technically do a much better job, right? So obviously you don't want to put AI in charge of the world's most, you know, biggest superpower, right? That's too scary of a thought at the moment. But there's going to be a lot of jobs that are going to be replaced in the future. So what does that mean? So people are ultimately is what's going to change. We're humans, humanity. So the biggest thing ASI will affect, you know, considering we build a proper democratic and, you know, a proper ecosystem with a set of rules that is clear that we're not going to be in danger from anything kind of going rogue. The major thing that will change is humanity. So, for example, it's already started. So today you could be out at a restaurant at the bar. Like there's a bar, what's it called out close Star by Bells. Here? Or even, what's the one I Hillstone. Close by, right? Yeah. I was at a Hillstone and I was sitting at the bar. And you've all seen this. Everyone that listens has seen this. And I'm at the bar and I look across. And there's maybe six people at the bar, you know, in the line, sitting there with a food or drink, whatever. And all six of them are sitting on their cell phones, right? Their heads are down. They're on their cell phone. No one's really making conversation, right? That's a humanity shift, a small one, but it's a humanity shift over the past, you know, 10 years,
yeah.
Right? Where the kids, you know, adults, they're all stuck on their phones, right? So it's a bit of a sad, I think everyone recognizes it's a sad thing. We kind of understand the benefits of it, but as far as humanity goes, it's like that's pretty sad. We're kind of losing it. We're kind of stuck in our own little digital world now. So imagine that 10 times. You know, this is where the first concern comes. It's not about, okay, the world is going to end. It's we're going to start to lose humanity.
Yeah.
And so part of that is, where a lot of experts think humanity is going, it's there's a system. They're looking at a united currency, yeah, you know, an equal income, an equal currency for like a universal currency for everyone, a status.
Except for the guys that designed the system.
Well, you know, you never know what's going to happen there, but they're saying, you know, that. Right now, let's pretend we're from a different planet, and you and I are going around. We're looking for a place to live. We're sick of Sector 5, you know, in the whatever quadrant, and we in our nice little ship come over here to speed of light. Oh, here's Earth. It looks great. So nice and shiny, blue, nice water. Oh, beautiful, great, some sunshine here. Oh, wait a second. So I just looked into it now. It seems at Earth to get in here, you have to work. They've got 7 days in their week, and out of 7 days in their week, you've got to work five of them. And then for 5 days of the week, you know, you start in the morning, you come home in the evening, and then on the weekend, you get 2 days off. So basically, we're saying to aliens out there that, hey, you want to come and work here? Well, you've got to do a five-day week, but we're only going to give you 2 days off. That doesn't seem like a fair life. That doesn't seem like a good life, right?
Unless you find purpose in your work.
Unless you find purpose in your work, of which the majority of people don't. Let's face it. Most people are, you know, 99.9% of people are working because they have to, not because they want to. Right. And, you know, so those aliens are like, you know what, this is a raw deal. Like, we're out of here. We're not going to work at Earth. We'll move somewhere else. And so if we really kind of take that into consideration, right, you know, humanity is not really doing a great job. You know, we're not really living. We're you know, our kids are in school. Schools are okay. It could be far better. You know, our politics in every country feels like a mess. The happiness level of people is not really true happiness. You know, kids, obviously with the social media, heads on the phone, the Instagram expectations, they're not as happy, nearly as happy that they used to be. Human relations with your neighbors compared to what they were when your parents were alive, their neighbors is far different. So humanity, in one way, I don't think is really doing a good job. And I think that you know, a big part of that is that we're driven to be working ultimately the majority of our lives. You know, we give so much and we get some back, but nowhere near as much as we put into it, I feel. And I mean, some people, obviously, this it's not for them. Another, I think a lot of people fit into this category where they don't want to work 5 days a week and get 2 days off. They'd rather work almost nothing. Obviously, we'd all rather just have happy and do good times. And ultimately, we all want to get there, but we can't afford to. But that's where things are going to change. That's where DSI, digital superintelligence, is going to start to take over so much of those tasks that people go to work for every day, then those people will have nothing to give to the workplace, right? They're not going to be useful. The intelligence, digital superintelligence, will ultimately replace the majority of human operators, you know, for many reasons, which most of them we would all agree with, right? The side effect is then, what are all these people going to do? Mm-hmm. So this is where humanity is epically going to change. So you have to create a sense of self-worth for people. So what's going to happen? So let's say you look at Elon, right? So Elon, you know, who a lot of people have heard him talk about AI. So there's a couple of things he believes in.
We're talking about Tesla CEO here, just for...
Yeah, so you know, I know Elon, right? So so he would say, okay, the least scary... This is some quotes from him I've written down, right, for the sake of this. So Elon, when he talks about AI, he would say, the least scariest future is one where we have a democratized AI. If it's not democratized, we're in deep shit. Mm-hmm. We're in big trouble. Okay, he feels also we could have an immortal dictator, and from which we could never escape, if that was to happen. If the machine consciousness, because remember, my brain is pretty small, my cortexes are pretty slow in comparison to this consciousness that we've created. I mean, we're creating literally a consciousness, and there's nothing humans have ever created in life that hasn't been from nature. I mean, just put that into perspective. I mean, everything, that cup, that laptop, the electricity, everything comes from the tools in the earth and, you know, science stuff, whatever. You know, machine consciousness is comes from nothing. It's from zeros and ones, digital. So it's extreme manipulation of digital electric microns, right? And we're creating, so even the concept of you know, a supercomputer, AI, artificial intelligence, for people, you know, you have to understand that humans are creating something for the first time that ultimately is from nothing. It's almost worth creating life, right? So I think you have to take that into consideration for how insane this is going to be in the future. Remember, electricity, the atom, AI is far beyond these things. It's going to change humanity in so many ways. So back to what Elon said as well. Okay, so he talks about ASI will be smarter than all humans combined, right? Even just one ASI computer. All humans combined, it'll be faster, quicker, smarter, right? AI is far more dangerous than nuclear warheads, he says, by a lot. So he asked, why don't we have obligatory oversight? Right now we don't, and it's insane. He wants to have close coupling between the human and digital intelligence, and we'll talk about Neuralink in a second. And then the merger with machine and digital intelligence to him is vital, which I agree with. The high bandwidth interface to the brain will maybe solve usefulness, but can we control the problem? So he then also talks about UBI, which is, UBI is a word you're going to hear quite
frequently.
Universal
basic income, I'm guessing.
Right, yeah. And ultimately, that's the ultimate balance of life. Happiness, humanity, it's really socialism 2.0. Bernie Sanders is going to be the absolute champion of UBI, right? And if you without going into politics, I've always been very pro-capitalist, very pro, like, just move things forward, stop whinging about stuff. You know, you got to work. I'm not going to give all these things out for free to people that just don't want to work and want to sit there on their couch, right? I'm not into that. You know, but socialism, the idea of socialism makes a lot of sense. I mean, I lived in Sweden for 7 years, right? Which is a very socialist country, as is Denmark, Finland, you know. But I'm as far from loving socialism when you see it in the country, how it works. I mean, the socialism ends up where people are a bit more mute. They're not really talking to each other. There's not a lot of conversations, not a lot of personality. I found in those kind of societies where everyone just kind of wants to be equal. You know, people don't really want to stand up or stand out of the crowd. So it creates a bit of a mundane kind of thing going on. And without going too much into that, that ultimately is the idea that no one should be unhappy. No one should be, you know, not equal. The idea is that they don't want people being hurt and people feeling bad about life, and they want everyone to be happy, right? Which in reality is commendable, right? It's just not practical. It doesn't make any... everyone would love to be happy and everyone to be happy, but it doesn't make sense in today's financial climate or geographic climates. It was just not possible.
It's also hugely contrary to human nature.
Right. There's that as well, right? And which, so you're getting more mute. It's like on the phones. Like, we're all stuck on phones. It's not human nature.
Yeah.
There's so many things about human nature that's dissolving. So, you know, what the problem with UBI is that, you know, you're going to get to the point where what the experts are expecting is that the average human ultimately is not going to have this lust and drive anymore to get the fancy house, get the fancy cars, et cetera, et cetera. Your happiness is going to come more from within, being human, how you communicate, the role you play in humanity. You know, back to the question, what are all these people going to do in the future when they don't have jobs? When computers, technology, hardware, ASI has ultimately taken over the majority of jobs, right? Like, just for example, New York Times bestseller books, right? In, you know, how long does it take to write a New York Times bestseller? You know, I don't know. Never written one, but probably at least 6 months a year. I have no idea.
I would guess so, yeah.
Right, but ASI will write it in 20 minutes. Not even. Even the most basic ASI. So, great movie lines, jokes, all that kind of stuff. ASI is going to ultimately take all those roles. Like, to write a phenomenal movie and produce it within 3D graphics that looks super realistic, that to write New York Times bestsellers, all that, all those jobs will be gone. Because ASI is going to do a far better job than you can do as a award-winning, you know, Nobel Prize winner, you know, New York Times best-selling author. Like, you don't have a chance against this stuff, right? So that will just give you a context of how so many people will ultimately be replaced. But then humanity needs to start then to focus on humanity. Because the focus of humanity, particularly over the past, you know, 100 years, has been very much about what can I give to life based on my 5 workdays a week. Mm-hmm. That has become so much the root of the drive of education, of social, you know, interactions. Everything is about what you're giving to life and what you're doing, what your job is, what your money is, what you're buying, all that kind of stuff. But is that really human happiness? We're just trying to get to happiness in some ways, but maybe fulfillment, you know, financial stability. But is it really happiness? I don't know. For some people, yes. I think for a lot of people, it's not, especially people that are not at the top end of the career echelon, the career spectrum. So that's where I think humanity and how humans become more human is going to be ultimately the role of the future if it's going in this path, as a lot of experts think.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of it's so philosophical in the sense that if you ask me, why are we here? What's the purpose of life? I would say to learn and hopefully progress, and who knows what comes next. But part of that is everything in our world is a game. That's why kids play games. Some people win, some people lose. Mm-hmm. This business, I view this business largely as a game in a lot of different ways. If you take away the game, you take away the purpose. And even that person, I would argue, that hates their job, they might, again, I lived in New York, I've said this several times to people, when I lived in New York City, Subway is the greatest place in the world for a psychological experiment. Because you have billionaires, maybe not so much billionaires, you have multi-millionaires riding that subway, you have homeless people riding the subway. Mm-hmm. And what I agree with you in the sense that 95% of them at least look miserable every single day.
Right.
But in their misery, there's purpose, because they're providing food for their child or their spouse, or they're adding something into it. And I can just say for myself personally, if you told me all of my needs would be met and I wouldn't have to work for them, my answer would be no, because what's the point?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people are going to agree with you on that.
And on that note, actually, I'm going to jump in here, and I realize we've gone close to an hour. And Dave, would you come back for this again?
I mean, there's a lot more to talk about. We've got to talk about the problems, China, Russia, Neuralink, simulation theory. That's where it gets exciting.
Okay, so to anyone listening, we're going to view part one here as the boot system, I guess, for the conversation that's going to continue in part two. And David, thank you so much for coming in here.
Yeah, no problem.
And we will schedule a part two if you are willing, and much appreciated.
Absolutely. I love this stuff.
Guys, this was fantastic. I can't say that enough. Fascinating stuff. I'm really looking forward to part two. So David, thank you so much for being here. Of course, Brent, thank you so much for bringing him on the show. And our last thank you always goes to you, listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Smart Money Simplified podcast with Brent Mikosh. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Brent comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it really easy to share these podcasts with your friends and family. And man, this is one to share. You want to have a good discussion? A long discussion? Share this one. Again, thank you so much for listening today. For everyone at MP Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Smart Money Simplified Podcast. Have any questions about topics covered during the show? Visit www.smartmoneysimplified.com or give us a call at 602-255-0555. Don't forget to click the follow button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the hosts and/or guests and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional financial advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service providers with any questions you may have regarding your individual situation. Securities are offered through Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated, member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Raymond James Financial Services Advisors Incorporated, MP Advisors, LLC, is not a broker/dealer and is independent of Raymond James Financial Services.